Okay, great. I'm going to move it more so that it's...
It's a good microphone.
Oh, it is.
No, no,
iPhone.
There's...
Okay, I think this is good.
No.
You want to shut that again?
Yeah.
I'm going to move that chair before I kick it every time I walk by. All right. Would you mind if I opened up in prayer? Probably. A bunch of heathens.
No, we wouldn't mind.
You wouldn't mind? Fantastic, because it'll calm me. Lord Jesus, thank you so much for this afternoon and for your word to us, which is a word of love, a word that draws us in, that calls us, that recreates us in mighty ways. And I pray that you would bless all of us here. That you would draw us to you, and that you would proclaim your word through my mouth, Lord. And I pray all of this in your name. Amen.
Amen.
So I'm here to talk about anxiety and suffering, two very lighthearted and winsome topics. So I'm actually impressed that anyone showed up, because they're sort of heavy. And I'm also going to be talking about the gospel, the good word of the gospel, and how the gospel addresses our anxiety and our suffering in real ways. I also want to talk about, briefly, how those of us who have heard the gospel, those of us who have been encountered by the incarnate word, those of us who have been called out by him, those of us who have gone through death by the word, the law, and brought back to life, recreated by the word of the gospel, the word of the promise, can be really and actually present with those others who are suffering and who are anxious. So that is my introduction. And so if you're in the wrong room, now's the time to leave. So anxiety and suffering. The way I'm going to do this is I'm going to talk about anxiety, and then I'm going to talk about suffering, hopefully pull them together, and then branch back out again, addressing them singularly from what we've talked about in regards to the gospel. So anxiety. Anxiety is defined as, this is according to dictionary.com, which is actually a bookmark on my toolbar because I love it, distress or uneasiness of mind caused by fear of danger or misfortune. The psychiatric definition is this: a state of apprehension and psychic tension occurring in some forms of mental disorder. And I'd like to say that that mental disorder is, simply put, just being human. And it's really true. Humans are anxious, and humans can be anxious. You have been, currently are, or will be at some point in the future anxious. I have had anxiety. I have anxiety with everything that... You know what's interesting about my anxiety is the fact that in a six-week period, I have flown to three different events, and I have spoken now six times, and I have a relatively newborn baby. But the 3 years leading up to that newborn baby, nothing. That's what I'm saying. If someone asks you when your twins are born, someone says, come talk. Anxiety can occur for many reasons. You can cause your own anxiety. For instance, my husband and I, about a couple months before we were engaged, he mentioned that he was, I'm planning on asking you to marry me sometime. And I was like, awesome. I spent the next 2 months so anxious about when that was happening. I was looking for it. Every time he's like, let's go out to the movies. I had so much anxiety that at some point I could only look in one direction. I was so tense, and I would talk to people. Hello. How are you? So you can cause your own anxiety. Or the circumstances in your life can cause you to have anxiety. A few years back, when I was completing my second master's degree, I was also involved with a new ministry. I was the mentor coordinator, and I was developing what it meant to be a mentor in terms of God's two words. I was writing a thesis. I had two boys. I was trying to find doctoral work and like driving multiple hours to meet with advisors. And I eventually just had to go to the doctor because I was having chest pain. And my heart would skip beats. And I said, I don't know, I think something's wrong. And she said, well, just tell me about your life. And I told her everything, and she was like, you have anxiety. And I was like, why? What would make you say that? She's like, well, are you sure about the doctoral level work? But she explained it to me that everything I was going under, I was under so much pressure, and I was just absorbing it and forcing myself through it that it was coming out in acid reflux, and my heart was really skipping a beat. During that time, though, oddly, we had a cat, Joe. He's passed on. My boys still pray for him. I don't have the heart to correct them, but they do. My cat, Joseph, did not have anxiety. And I would, during these times, I'd watch him, and I would sit there sleeping, and I'm all not being able to look in one direction. And he would sometimes wake up, look at me, kind of wink, go back to sleep. I think he's rubbing it in my face. He doesn't have anxiety. Joe wasn't anxious at all. Not like a shred of anxiety in my cat, Joe. And if some of you, actually, Deborah, you might be the only one who actually met Joe. But Joe was the cat that cat haters love. He was a dog. I'm serious. One of the fundamental reasons why my cat, Joe, was not anxious was because his work essentially involved sleeping, eating, occasionally batting something around, and his work never oppressed him. He enjoyed everything he did. To be oppressed by work is really unique to human beings, and anxiety is the manifestation of the realization of the oppression of work. Did that make sense? There's a lot of shuns in there. So it's uniquely human. Humans can be oppressed by work. If you have anxiety, there's good news. It means you're human. Anxiety represents the awareness I have when I realize that I am no longer in control. The chief times I have anxiety is when it seems like everything is colliding and I have no plan of attack. That's really when my anxiety is going to sort of peak. I have no idea how to begin to comprehend what I have to get done. I begin to fear. I have fear of failure, fear of everything collapsing, fear of disappointing everyone. From advisors to employers to my husband, my children, and even myself. The definition that I gave for anxiety is right. Anxiety incorporates fear of something occurring that is beyond our control. To go further than that, anxiety is also the association between works and person that is so closely bound together that the work defines the person. I have anxiety when I do not do well on a paper because I see myself as a good student. So anything that comes back lower than that, is I start to like appropriate into my person. I have anxiety with the work involved to be a good mother or a good wife because my work defines whether or not I am good or bad. When the work and the person are so intricately linked, anxiety is bound to rear its head. I have a prop. You guys are going to love it. I bet there's one for everyone in here. I also have humor to defray when I'm nervous, you know, like Twizzlers. Have you ever seen these candies? This is a human being who's anxious. This centerpiece, hold on a second, I won't give you this one. That's you. Bound up with your works. It takes a lot of work to unbind this. We'll talk about that. But this is an image. This is a really good, in my opinion, it's also a good image if you're ever talking about Karl Barth's theology. It works. But it's the person, the centerpiece is all bound up with these other 8 strands. And it's one piece. So intricately bound. So I really want you to have that image in your head. Now you all want one because I opened the package. I'll go ahead and pass it around. I have another package that I'll pass this way. It's nice and candy. I don't think any other guy's brought candy. When the work and the person are so intricately linked, anxiety is bound to rear its head. When it's all riding on what you do or how you perform, you're bound to experience some stress, to say the absolute least. Anxiety is the tangible and palpable sign that the scales have tipped too much in one direction. My work defines who and what I am, whether or not I am good or bad. It tips in the direction of relentless self-justification. Just think of a hamster on a wheel or a treadmill. Just spin, 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 not going anywhere. The best thing the world can give in response to our anxiety is tricks, essentially tricks. Tricks and tips not only to rid ourselves of anxiety, but also tricks to avoid it. Go for a run. Meditate. Take a deep breath. Just let go. That's my favorite. Just let it go. If I stopped feeding my kids, there would be very angry 7-year-old in five. Take control. That's another one. That's another one of my favorites. Take control of the situation. That's actually the problem. Or something therein. Don't let whatever it is bother you. And a lot of those things are good. Going for a run certainly can release anxious energy. I run. I also do high-intensity interval training, which if you really love the sensation of wanting to be sick after you work out, I would encourage it. I'm addicted to it. But running exercise can be great. I do take deep breaths. For the past week, I have been taking a deep breath telling myself, just get to 3 p.m., but then the speaker spoke late. So now it's like, just get to 4. Just get there. You're taking a deep breath. And I can really feel, when I take those deep breaths, I can feel it's good to breathe. But the problem is there's still something surging underneath that needs to be addressed. And taking that deep breath is not going to address it. Because all those suggestions on how to manage it fail because the assumption is that the answer resides in me, in you. They also fail to address the real problem or that the problem is in fact real. Anxiety isn't merely a psychological state, but also a physical one. It's not merely something I perceive as happening. If I could just clear my head, I wouldn't have anxiety. But something that is happening to me. Something's happening to me that's real, that's causing me to have this anxiety. Deep breaths may calm my heart rate, as I just said, and a run might help me display some of the anxious energy I have, but neither address the cause or the source of my anxiety. My very person has cleaved to works. And I use that word specifically because in Genesis it says, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. And that cleaving is like glue. My personhood is cleaved to works in such a way that it's like glue. It's like a peel and pull Twizzler, but it's so bound up. And that in that it's so intertwined with my work, my person is so intertwined with my work that my work defines me. And this is the real tricky part, or not the tricky part, but something that I don't think we really often think about. In that intertwinedness, in that cleaving, in that trying to self-justify by my works, works now dominates me. This is not how it's supposed to be. Anxiety is a warning bell that things are in disorder. In some way, anxiety can be seen as a gift because it exposes the truth of the situation that I'm typically blind to, that I'm human and I'm not in control, and that I need something more than just some good breathing techniques and yoga positions, that I need something not me, in fact, that I need intervention from the outside. And so it is also with suffering. I spent a good deal trying to figure out how I could speak to both anxiety and suffering, because the two to me seem different, and I've suffered and I have anxiety and they feel different. While anxiety is associated with fear, the broader category of fear, suffering is associated with pain, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Properly defined, suffering is to undergo or feel pain or distress, and to undergo, be subjected to, or endure pain, distress, injury, loss, or anything unpleasant. But the more I thought about anxiety and suffering, it began to dawn on me that they are the two sides of one coin. Often, anxiety can lead to suffering, and suffering can actually cause anxiety. They start to interplay with each other. Anxiety is the real state that occurs because something is out of my control. Suffering is the real state that occurs because something has happened that is out of my control. Each time I miscarried, I had 3 miscarriages. The question that I would ask would be, could I have done something differently? I so desperately wanted to lay hold of something that would give me control. the next time. The next time it will be that way. The answer was always the same, though. No, it's out of your control. The suffering you're experiencing now is out of your control. There's nothing you could have done to have prevented it. Suffering is suffering because it happens to us, is out of our control, and is the all-too-alert awareness that the world is broken. That the world is still under the rampages of the first effects of Genesis 3. Suffering happens because things aren't all right. Things aren't okay. It's not okay. I had a discussion with my five-year-old. I yelled at him, and I said, I came back to him later, I felt very bad, and I came up to him, and I got down on my knees, and I said, Jack, Mommy's sorry. I'm sorry I yelled at you. And he goes, Mommy, it's okay. And I paused. I looked at him and said, Jack, it's not okay. Would you forgive me? And he said, yes, I forgive you. And I was crying. But it's not okay. Marriages that dissolve, that's not okay. It happens. It doesn't mean it's okay. Losing pregnancies is not okay. Hopes and desires unfulfilled, it's not okay. When parents bury children or parents and children aren't getting along, it's all not okay. It happens. But it's a warning sign that things still aren't. It's groanings and yearnings like a woman in labor for the Savior to come back, to finish it, to rectify it all completely. Where anxiety is the pressure from work's domination over us, suffering is the invasion of the very tangible brokenness into our lives. Both demand and the same exclamation, this I cannot bear. Both anxiety and suffering are the result of events that happen to us from the outside, not just locked away in our minds. They aren't mental states to be altered. And that's the thing about both anxiety and suffering. You are made aware that there is no remedy or cure for either within yourself. Because it's yourself that's affected, ill and sick. It's yourself that's hurting. And if you have only yourself to deal with it, and that self is a poor physician because it's not well, it's sick, you are utterly lost to the anxiety and the suffering. It has the final word. Both anxiety and suffering back us into a corner, rendering us and all of our tools and weapons useless. All of our coping devices fail in the wake of suffering and anxiety. You can yoga out until you can't yoga anymore and you may still have anxiety. Anxiety by fear and suffering through pain, exposing our epidermal layer, bringing us to our knees and drawing out the confession, I am not in control and I need help. And there is help. The gospel does address our anxiety and our suffering, and not merely psychologically, but physically, tangibly, in the here and now, because the word is a creative word. The word that spoke everything into existence in the beginning speaks again as the incarnate word. And when he speaks, things happen. Creation happens again. When Jesus says to the paralytic, take up your mat and walk, the paralytic stands and walks away with his bed. People are brought back to life by his spoken word. When the storm rages and Jesus speaks, there's calm. That was actually a passage that was on my head when I was writing this whole thing. Don't you care? We're about to die. Don't you care? Rebukes the winds. And everything's calm. It's a creative word. When Jesus says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. There is rest because he has called it into existence, because he himself is rest. In John's gospel, we read, in the beginning was the word, and the word is with God, and the word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Jesus, the Word incarnate, is the light, writes John, and the darkness cannot overcome it. Jesus, the Word through whom all things were made, creates light because in him is light. Where he is, there is light, and darkness cannot coexist in the same spot with light. It's either light or it's dark. The light scatters the darkness and sends it running. So too can be said of his rest, of his peace. He is rest, and anxiety cannot overcome him. He is comfort, and suffering cannot overcome him. Jesus' word never falls to the ground, and it never comes back empty. God's promises are future facts, because his word creates the very thing it desires. Rest for the heavy laden, comfort for those who are burdened by suffering and sorrow, peace for the anxious. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Because he is rest, and he's called you to himself. The word creates, and creates when it calls as well. Jesus does a lot of calling. I love that. I love the when he calls. And when Jesus calls people, they come. When Jesus calls Peter and Andrew, they drop their nets and come. When he calls James and John, I'm guessing, they jump out of a boat and follow him. Both pairs come and follow immediately. When Jesus calls Legion, the demons, to come out of the man, tortured for many years, they flee. When Jesus calls for Lazarus, he rises from the dead and comes out of the tomb. When Jesus calls Martha, he calls her from where she is to himself. Luke chapter 10, verses 38 to 42, I'm going to read them. Now, as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she went up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me alone to serve? Tell her then to help me. But the Lord answered her, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her. Martha is distracted or busied with many things, and she vents her frustration to Jesus over that fact that Mary is not assisting her with her work. Martha is compelled and put under pressure to such an extent that she can't take it anymore, that her sister is not helping her, her sister who is just sitting there in Martha's eyes. So she solicits Jesus to remedy the situation. Now, I'm not big into vilifying Martha. Martha is actually doing good things. She's being a great hostess. She's preparing food and getting everything ready. Jesus has come into her home. If Jesus came into my home, I would probably be doing the same thing. I'd probably be cleaning up and distracting him and saying, don't look over here. That's the laundry. But I would slip right in there. I can't vilify Martha. She's doing a good thing. And she's doing what is very much expected of her. Not only expected of her, but also of Mary. Mary's actually the rebel, sitting at Jesus' feet, not doing what she should have been doing. Yet Mary has left her sister to do the work, and Martha is feeling the weight of getting it all done. And she's realized that by herself, all by herself, she can't do it. She is exasperated, which is indicated by her question, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the work? Some people have criticized Martha for having a skewed perspective, that she values the work over the guest, who is Jesus. While it is skewed and wrong, it's not that she just has a skewed perspective, it's that she is, for all intents and purposes, bound up in her work. She's not necessarily choosing the work over Jesus voluntarily, but that she can't do anything else at that moment. Because the work at that moment has the louder voice, and it's actually dominating her. And this is indicated by the distracted by many things. She's worried and anxious about how it will all get done if her sister does not help her. Martha isn't off by a little bit, just a bit off center. She's wrapped up in her work. She's wrapped up in it to the point that she is worried and anxious. She's so worried and anxious, and the fact that her sister isn't helping exacerbates her anxiety and worry, that she's forced out of herself. She can't do it alone, so she questions Jesus. She calls out, do you not care? Don't you care that my sister has left me to do all the work? And she desires for Jesus to intervene. And this is why I love Martha, specifically here in this moment where she's calling out, do you not care? She is full of total humanity. This isn't to say that Mary is not full of humanity as well. She actually represents true humanity. She is sitting where she should be sitting, at the foot of Jesus, worshiping him. She is loving God with all her mind, heart, strength, and soul. She is exhibiting what it means to love God, as the first commandment dictates. Mary has chosen the better part, but what I love about Martha is that she needs to be brought out of herself, out of any delusions that she is in control. Her anxiety forces her to call out, to call for help, without first going through where Martha is or what Martha is experiencing. We do not get to the position of Mary. We cannot recognize the good unless we have been forced to come face to face with the good and caused to recognize it. We need to be called out and brought to the good, and there is no better place from which to start than at the end of your rope and ready to give up. Martha, when she questions Jesus and asks him to help, to intervene, says, "I can't. I can't do all of this on my own. I can't do this by myself. I can't bear this burden alone." And she knows that he can actually do something. She's very wise to go to him. "Tell her then to help me. Do something," Martha requests or demands. And he does. Jesus does do something, but it's not what Martha expected. Rather than command Mary to help her sister, Martha, Jesus calls Martha to himself. And actually thinking about this passage this week, I sort of paused over that. Isn't that interesting? The one thing that's going to help Martha is not the law. It's not a command to her sister. It's that Jesus is going to call her to himself. At the end of her rope and completely frustrated and full of anxiety over what has to get done, he, the living word, the gospel, calls her to him. Jesus is Jesus. He is not another Moses. He lovingly addresses Martha, which is indicated by the double use of her name in that passage. I look at my son, Jack. Jack. It's a term of love, not condemnation. He emotes his concern for her preoccupation with many things. He paints a picture of a woman who is overwhelmed, who is anxious and troubled. You notice Jesus, Luke writes that she's distressed, anxious, and Jesus says, "You are anxious and troubled over many things." He sort of heightens it, actually gets to the core. She is anxious and troubled. Jesus proclaims, "But one thing is necessary." This is Jesus preaching himself. He is the good portion. Then this good portion calls to Martha, beckons to her. "Martha, Martha, you are worried and anxious about many things." He illuminates her anxiety. He heightens it. He illuminates her being bound up in her work, but he does not chastise her for it. And he does not simply say, "Stop it. Just let it go. Stop being anxious, Martha. It's wrong. You shouldn't be anxious. Don't be anxious. Don't have grief. Don't sorrow. Get a grip. Get control." He doesn't say any of that. And this is the one of the fundamental differences between the law and the gospel. The law is static and the gospel is dynamic. The law cannot get you to do what it commands, and it can only command, "Do this, don't do this, don't be anxious, be happy." But it cannot beckon nor cause you to hear it, to do it. It can only leave you in its judgment, whether or not you've done or haven't done it. That's what it decides, yes or no, good or bad. The gospel does go farther. Farther. When it calls, it creates, which is why I had that whole portion about the word creating and Jesus calling and things happening. Because when it calls, it creates. What it creates is time and space. It stops time and it moves space. And addresses, not confronts, but addresses, calls lovingly the addressee, "Martha, Martha." And the gospel takes the hearer and moves her, walks her to its decision, to its, the gospel's conclusion. The gospel seizes the one who hears and brings her to the foot of the cross, to the feet of Jesus. I always imagine when Jesus calls Martha, Martha, she steps out of the kitchen. Now who's she looking at? Jesus. She has to be reoriented. To get to the position of Mary, I must be called out of my anxiety in the midst of my anxiety in the same way Martha has been called out. I must first hear the beckoning of the gospel. I must hear the tender, loving call of the God who is love through the proclamation of the gospel. Lauren, Lauren, I am the good portion, the only thing that is necessary. And in that hearing, the type of hearing that actually defines the word Shema from the Old Testament, from Deuteronomy, Shema, to hear so deeply that you do, I am brought to Jesus' feet to the point that I can recognize the good portion when it enters the room. I have to be reoriented. Jesus, the gospel message, enters into our mess, our disordered priorities, our chaos, our anxiety, our sorrow and our suffering. Jesus enters into our pain, our emotional and spiritual and physical turmoil. And Jesus draws us out and into relation with him. And in that relation with him, we are given the good portion, the only necessary thing. We are given rest. We are given comfort and peace because he has given us himself. As it is for anxiety, so it is for suffering. As a sufferer, I need to be called out of myself in the midst of my suffering. I don't need to get beyond it. I need to be met right there in that suffering. I need to be called to look not down at myself, turned inward. It's always how I imagine the first man, or Adam, before Eve, curved in. He's lonely, kind of curved in on himself. He needs to be pulled up. Same thing with me. I need to be pulled up and out. So not looking at myself, but looking up at Jesus, I need to raise my face to see him, to see this God who is merciful and unyielding in his love, who by the life of his one and only Son, through the event of the incarnation and the cross, has declared, it will not always be so. Darkness, depression, sorrow, suffering, grief, and pain have been given their verdict, and that verdict is no. And we have been given ours, and it's yes. Suffering has a unique way of drawing us to the suffering God who suffered for us on the cross, who was raised from the dead and has declared that the suffering of this life will not last forever, that it's not the final word, and that he has conquered it. Suffering draws us to this God who is not far off. When we are at our worst, our ugliest, our decrepit, our most sick or infirm, maimed, even when we are angry at him about our own suffering or the suffering of those close to us. Suffering draws us this God who has come close and breathes into our nearly breathless lungs. Lungs carried in bodies exhausted from the battle and pelted by the hailstorms of pain and loss. Bones made brittle by unfulfilled pleas and petitions. It is this God who breathes into our lungs and resuscitates us from the dead, gives us real and true life, new hearts, causes us to love him and to love others, and uses all those things intended for evil, for good. Even in suffering, the light cannot overcome the dark. The darkness cannot overcome the light. Even those things that were intended for evil are used for good. For us sitting here today, those of us who aren't demanding Jesus to get our lazy sister up off the ground to help us out, those of us who do not have the privilege of actually hearing our names flow from Christ's mouth, this being called out, this being brought out of the entanglement of works to Christ himself, happens when the gospel is proclaimed and we are given ears to hear. The gospel is this: Jesus died for my transgressions and was raised for my justification. I am justified by faith apart from works. This is the core of the gospel message. This is the doctrine by which the church stands or falls. The gospel exposes my situation for what it is, out of my control, and not only that, but also this, that Jesus is in control. In both anxiety and suffering, we are the ones not in control. In our anxiety and suffering, we need to hear that he is. And this is what I hear proclaimed when the gospel is preached. The gospel message tells me that I am neither defined by my failures nor my successes, nor am I defined by the events that happened to me that caused me my pain and suffering. I am not defined by what I do, whether good or bad, nor am I defined by what is done to me at the hand of other people, or by life, or by the brokenness of the world in general. I need to continually hear this message to be continually reminded about this very gospel message, because I am slow on the uptake. I am filled with doubt, and my defaults often want to take hold, and one of my defaults is works righteousness. And that's actually my love language, which I always have to apologize to my husband, but it is. So I'm sorry, honey. I do understand the distinction between law and gospel, but unfortunately, works. He's like, you get off easy. He's like, for me, it's touch. You just have to touch my shoulder. He's like, I do get off easy. Yeah, there you go. I need to continually hear this message. In hearing repeatedly, I'm given rest from my anxieties because I am not my deeds, my failures, or my successes. I can go out and fail, or I can actually go out and succeed, neither one of them defining me. None of it has any bearing on who or what I am. In hearing the proclamation of the gospel and my anxiety, something actually happens to me. It's real time. My cleaving to my work is put asunder, and this requires major surgery, much like the surgery and operation Adam underwent to be rid of his loneliness and alienation. It's actually best if you peel them. I had to do this. We built gingerbread houses for Christmas. Mm-hmm. Did you see what I did there? I broke me. But it takes a lot of work to go through this unbinding process. Here I am. My cleaving to my work is put asunder, and this requires major surgery. I am brought through death into new life. I am recreated. And consequently, I am set free, and in being set free, work no longer has domination over me, but rather, I am given back dominion over work. Genesis 1, have dominion over the earth and subdue it. Activity transitions from toil, Genesis 3, to keeping in Genesis 1 and 2. There's a difference in those words. It's not toil. That's what it says in Genesis 3, you will toil upon the earth. That's the domination of work over us. Work becomes just work, voiceless and silenced, unable to carry with it a judgment about me. There is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. It has no voice. So it's just work. I am given time and space to be exposed by the light, utterly exposed and naked, and given the freedom to confess my transgressions. I can step into that time and space, or actually that time and space has been created around me by the calling or even the alluring of Jesus, of me to Jesus, and I step in there and everything falls off of me as if I was Teflon, and I'm free to respond. I'm free to even confess. I'm free to confess that I have anxiety. That I honestly didn't know how this talk was going to happen. That this morning I uttered the words, why in the world did I say yes to this? Because I was up. And I was up from the hours of 2 until 6. And I'm standing still. Currently still standing. I'm actually not standing still. I'm too Greek to actually stand still. But that's that. That exposing, when Jesus sits at the base of the well and speaks with the Samaritan woman and exposes her, he doesn't run when he says, you have had 5 husbands, not just one, but it's 5. He actually pushes through, the light exposes, and it's safe. It's safe to be naked. In hearing the gospel, something actually happens to me as I am in my suffering. Time and space are given to me to sorrow. To grieve, to weep, because it's all been taken care of by the one who died to restore, or rather to recreate by his word, his promise, his love, to recreate this broken and fallen world, to undo what has been done. I'm also given the room to be angry and to vent, to ask, why did you let that happen? I've had those moments in my life. Because these actions have no more bearing on my justification than other actions. If we're going to be naked in the light because of our transgressions, in our transgressions, it's all there. He sees everything. Then what's going on in my heart when I'm in pain, is seen, and he still loves, and he pursues me, and he allures me. So when I try to put up the Christian, everything's fine. This actually happened. We had just lost our third pregnancy, and a friend was over. This was the last time she was ever over. And we were talking about having more children. I said, well, I would like to have one more. That was sort of our hope. And she's like, oh, but aren't you happy with two? And I was so angry, because it wasn't that I wasn't happy with what I had, is that I had this other desire, and she couldn't handle that I was putting out, well, we would like to have another one, but it's been hard. We haven't been able to have that yet. But she couldn't handle that. She wanted me to be like, everything's fine, and I'm happy with everything I get. And that's not the truth. Lamentations is a book in the Bible, and it is all about people asking the question, why? David, Psalm 88, have you read that? There's no hopeful ending. David typically always has a hopeful ending. Psalm 88, absolutely not. When you are in the light and you are exposed and you are naked and you are loved, you can confess even those things. I don't want to read my Bible. I am angry at God because of... He's big. He's a big God. He can take it. Sorrow and suffering in Christ, rather than leading to despair, lead to comfort and hope, because suffering leads us to Him who is comfort and hope, to the one who knows suffering and knows you and sees you. And I'm bold enough to say that apart from Christ, there is no comfort or hope. If He is comfort and hope, then apart from Him, there isn't. At least not in a true, real sense. You might have these little snippets or these little momentary and temporary things, but not the real true, not the thing that gets you through the dark night of the soul. It's not about us never having anxieties. It's not even about us never suffering, but rather what we need when we face head on both anxiety and suffering, because I'm quite certain we will experience these again as we walk through life. I have been thinking about anxiety and suffering for multiple years, and I was still talking myself off the ledge of anxiety again this week. It's going to come up. You're human. We need this gospel message, the message of the justification of sinners. We need to hear regularly that God is in control and it's not up to us, because we can't do it. We're not God, and that's good news. We are first to be created into hearers, lovingly called by the Good Shepherd, and only then are we recreated to be responders. We must first hear like Martha to respond like Mary. One aspect that I wanted to draw out was how do we as hearers interact with those who are suffering? And so another consequence of being called by the creative word by God himself, of hearing the gospel of the justification of sinners, is that not only am I turned toward God and rightly aligned with him, but I am also now turned toward you, my neighbor. For the first time, as a result of my encounter with the cross, I may and probably will see you for who you are, as a human being struggling with your brokenness, your besetting sins, your own disappointments, humiliations, failures, and bad days. Essentially, I, for the first time, see you as you, not as some superhuman that should do everything right while I do everything wrong, but I see you as another human just like I am. Because of my hearing the gospel of the justification of sinners, of which I am one, I can sit with you in the dark. Because of my hearing of this gospel, I can sit with you and actually listen to you. Really listen. Lay down my life listening. Paul and Mary Zald have taught courses about listening. They actually did one here a few years back. And I've always been struck with the listening. It seems very passive. It's where you listen. You don't say anything. It's very hard. You think it's easy, but then you actually get in a circumstance. And it's very hard to sit and listen. And I've always wondered, why does that work? What's functioning in the background there? And then it dawned on me. Put yourself aside. And the other person speaks. Listening is a byproduct of the stone heart turned flesh. It's exceptionally powerful. Really being there in a passively active way, focusing just on the person talking, letting them talk, and letting them tell you about who they are or what's going on with them. Listening is powerful because while it seems like the opposite of activity and doing and acting, it's quite powerful and quite active. When we move ourselves out of the way, we simultaneously create a space for the person, for the other person to fill. Remember how I was talking about how the word, the actual act of justification, what it does, the forgiveness, the pronouncement that you are forgiven, enters in and like stops time and moves space, and actuality becomes oriented towards possibility rather than the opposite. And there's this space there. And what, how listening functions on a neighbor-to-neighbor level is the exact same way. I essentially block out. I stop. I create this space. And I listen. It's incredibly powerful. And that's why it's so, that's why it works so well. This is why Paul and Mary Zell teach it. It's one of the most, I don't know if I'm hesitant to say this, but if I were to call anything a gospel activity, I would say that this might be one of them. In listening. Sitting with someone and listening is a gospel event because it stops time, it moves space, and it brings the hearer to their conclusion. Without you interjecting or guiding, you let them talk. It grants what we also often want, time and space. Like the act of forgiveness and the gospel itself, when we listen, we give the other, our neighbor, that time and space. They tell us who they are, what they are doing, what they are feeling, what they are suffering, what's causing them anxiety. Listening is excruciatingly pastoral and desperately desired and needed. And if you don't believe me, just get on Facebook. And the problem with Facebook is that no one's listening, but everyone wants to be heard. We give the other the benefit of the doubt. They are broken human beings in need of love and being heard. There's this Moth episode that I heard one Sunday night, and it was about the this woman is a airline stewardess, and she's very, it was very funny, but she was talking about how, like, oh, she's like, if you want to see horrible, how horrible humanity is, you just need to wrap them up in a metal tube and send them in the air. And so, and she just, you know, for years and years would have to tell people, stop doing that, can you sit down, and can you, she just got tired of it. I don't remember the details of the story because it's been like a year and a half since I heard it, and my memory is shot because, again, I've been up since 2. But there's this time where she's sitting and she's flipping through a magazine, and this is right after 9/11, like right after. And a guy gets up who had come onto the plane just carrying like a white trash bag. She was like, that's a little odd, but what are you going to do? It's people in an airplane. So anyway, he gets up and there's no standing. This is when like sort of like all the rules and regulations kind of came down hard. And he stood up, I forget to do what, but he was standing up. And she just was so tired of telling people what to do, she just remained silent. She looked at him, he looked at her, and she said, I think maybe the most that she said was, hey, how are you? And there was a silence. And the man opened up about how he was, it always gets me, how he was flying home with his son's clothing, because he had died in 9/11, and he opens up to her. Had she spoken one word about, please, sir, you need to be in your seat right now, that moment would have been gone. Sitting with someone in their sorrow and pain and suffering and listening to them is a beautiful act of compassion from one human being to another. It's practically the one way that one-way love is really reproduced between two people. There's marriage, that's a separate thing, but between... It's the epitome of Christian love, in my opinion. Really listening. Because you know your own lack of being the one in control. You know you don't and can't fix your neighbor's problem. You don't have to lift them out of their sadness or stress, but you can just be there with them. Sitting with someone and listening cultivates an environment that lets the mess be messy. When we try to jump in and clean it up, we expose that we are very uncomfortable with the messiness of suffering and anxiety. Don't get your mess on me. I'm uncomfortable. That's what my friend was doing. Turns out she actually wound up having a third child. But what happened when I confessed that I wanted one? It triggered her own pain of not having one. Don't get your mess on me. But we are a mess. We have had or have anxiety. We have suffered or are currently suffering. So it's perfectly fine to be with someone else in their suffering and anxiety. Just sit there with them. I've had friends who have lost pregnancies and I have emailed them or called them and just said, if it's 2 a.m, I'll listen. I'll never get tired. I'll never get tired of hearing you. When we've been brought through our own sufferings and our own anxieties, and we are encountered by other sufferers along the way, we don't turn around and hand them stone tablets. Here, these will help you out. We pick them up. We bear each other's burdens because we can, because we're not actually bearing them. They're already born. And in remembering that we are not the ones in control to fix or solve our neighbor's problems, we remember who is in control and that we can come to him with all of our ailments and problems, petitions and pleas boldly in prayer. Prayer emphasizes that we are utterly dependent on God and we can rest assured that we do have an advocate before the Father who is Jesus Christ, who intercedes for us, who hears us, who truly hears us, and who knows our suffering and our anxiety and calls us to himself. Come to me, all ye who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. If there's anything you need prayer for, I would be more than happy to sit and pray with you or even sit and listen. I know that I talked about some emotionally charged topics, so I would offer myself, and if anyone else has the time or to listen and maybe pray with someone, that would be great. But no obligation, just wanted to offer that if I could. Did all the Twizzlers get eaten? Deb, I can't stop it.
Thank you. I've been especially wrapped up the past 2 weeks and just only being able to see myself in terms of what I do. And it's really helpful.